top of the ramp and halt, her hands folded neatly in front of her. She wore a steely lavender dress and bolero with grey accents and a matching lavender blouse. She wore her hat at a rakish angle upon her pinned-up hair, and a crystal the size of a big man's thumb glowed with gentle light at the center of a velvet choker about her slender throat. Her gaze was focused directly upon Master Ferris even as her head rose above the level of the deck, as if she had known precisely where he would be standing long before she had actually laid eyes upon him. Those flat grey eyes took in Ferris for a moment, and then Cavendish smiled. It was, Grimm thought, the cruelest expression he had ever seen on a human face. Then she turned to Grimm, and her smile reminded him of nothing so much as a primed gauntlet ready to be discharged.
"Captain Grimm," she said, "what a pleasure to see you again, sir. And what a lovely ship this is. Permission to come aboard for parley?"
Grimm turned his head slightly toward Master Ferris, but never took his eyes off Cavendish.
"Sir," he said quietly, "ought we take her?"
"You can't," Ferris said, his voice roughened with emotion.
"You haven't the necessary tools."
Grimm frowned.
"You think we should parley with her?"
"Merciful builders and God in heaven, no,"
Ferris murmured back.
"She cannot be trusted."
"Offer her tea."
Grimm pursed his lips.
"For what reason?"
"She has us at a disadvantage, Captain, or she wouldn't be here at all. She wishes to talk, or she would simply have attacked. Let us see what she has to say."
"Is she a danger to my men?" Grimm asked.
Master Ferris's teeth showed briefly.
"To all men. Invite her to take tea before the winds change."
He touched Grimm's arm and lowered his voice intently.
"And, Captain, do let us be gracious about it."
Grimm frowned at the old etherealist for a moment more before nodding. Then he turned, doffed his cap, and swept a politely proper bow to the lady.
"Permission granted, Madame Cavendish. Welcome aboard Predator. May I tempt you with a cup of tea?"
Cavendish stepped onto the deck of Grimm's ship, and her smile didn't widen so much as sharpen.
"Why, what a gracious offer! Yes, Captain. Tea would be lovely. Tea would please me to no end."
Grimm fought down an odd sensation of manifest dread and offered the woman his arm. She took it, and the contact made him feel as if his flesh had begun to desperately bunch up in an effort to avoid contact with the woman's fingers. But he allowed none of that to show in his bearing or voice.
"This way, please, madame. If I may be so bold as to ask, do you prefer sugar or honey in your tea?"
Chapter 46. Spire Albion, Habel Landing Shipyards, AMS Predator. Grimm did not, as a rule, believe in extravagance. That said, he did own a rather finely made teapot. The device was specifically made for use aboard airships, plugging into the electrical system of a ship upon two slender copper prongs. Electricity flowed into a coil upon which sat the copper teapot, and heated the water inside to the ideal temperature in well under a minute, shutting off immediately when the water was perfectly heated. As it was the deluxe model, it even had a dial on the side to adjust for altitude in order to make sure the pot was heated to precisely the correct temperature every time. Grimm heated the water, then added the leaves and let them steep for a few moments. Then he brought the tea to the little table in his cabin, around which sat Master Ferris and Madame Cavendish.
"Oh, is that the Fedori model?" out of Spire Gerizi?
Cavendish asked, looking up with interest.
I'd considered acquiring one myself, for when I'm travelling. But so few airships have their passenger cabins wired for electricity.
And something of an indulgence of mine, I'm afraid, Grimm said. I don't mind missing meals when it comes to that, but I simply can't do without a good cup of tea in the afternoon.
At least you and I can agree on that, Captain,
Cavendish said firmly.
If you would care to do the honours, Master Ferris, Grimm said.
Why, certainly,
Ferris said. He poured the tea, his expression neutral.
I have less than fresh cream, I'm afraid, Grimm said.
But I believe you said that you prefer it with honey, madame.
Please,
Cavendish said, holding out her cup to Grimm.
He dipped what was very nearly the last of his rather expensive honey out of its ceramic bowl and into the matching cup upon its saucer.
Master Ferris?
Sugar, if you please,
Ferris said calmly.
Grimm served them, added a bit of both to his own tea, and left it sitting on its saucer to cool a bit, as did his guests.
I must say,
Madame Cavendish said,
given the innovations made in simple quality-of-life contrivances upon airships, it seems that there is vast potential in electrically powered products, such as your fine teapot, that could be expanded into the lifestyle of spire dwellers as well.
In a gentler world, perhaps, madame, Grimm said.
Oh?
Power crystals are valuable resources, Grimm said. Given the amount of time required to produce them, they are nearly always slated for use aboard airships, and the expansion of each spire's navy in today's troubled world is an absolute priority. Cavendish's eyes glittered with an amusement that hardly seemed to match the topic.
Much to the loss of the poor citizens of the spire, whom the airships are meant to serve and protect, I dare say.
Necessity and survival, Madame Cavendish, needs must take precedence over convenience.
Except for airship captains, it would seem,
Cavendish said.
Consider the Fedori Company. Think how rapidly their shops would grow if they could supply demand for so large a market. And who knows what other products might be made available. Supplying to the citizenry of the spires could usher in a new era of peace and prosperity.
Well said, Cora,
Master Ferris murmured.
I almost believed you meant that.
Cavendish lifted her nose and sniffed lightly.
You have always believed the worst about me, Ferris.
And rarely have been disappointed, Ferris replied.
Your notion seems perfectly sound, Grimm said smoothly. In theory. But I am afraid it would suffer once exposed to the harsh realities of life.
Cavendish stared hard at Master Ferris.
A valid point, Captain. So many theories do.
Master Ferris did not quite flinch at the woman's words, but Grimm sensed the slow, long-term pain in the etherealist's face. The old man looked up at Cavendish and said gently,
It needn't be this way between us, you know. The future has many branches.
No, Ferris,
Madame Cavendish said. Grimm was startled by the precise vitriol the woman managed to fit into the two words. They dripped with it to such a degree that he nearly checked the decking beneath the woman's chair for damage. Master Ferris sighed and nodded.
Then you never learned to see, I take it.
Perhaps I had a poor teacher,
she replied calmly.
But in time, I learned to create the future I desired.
Oh, Cora,
Ferris said.
Is that what you think this is?
Creation. Building a new world is never easy, my old friend,
she replied. A small smile touched the corners of her mouth.
What fun would it be if it were easy?
As a loyal son of Albion, Grimm knew more or less to the second when his tea would be cool enough to drink. He reached for his cup, and the other two moved to do the same at precisely the same time. They all sipped. Cavendish closed her eyes in pleasure for a moment before opening them.
"To business, then, shall we?"
"Of course," Master Ferris said. "Where do you propose to begin negotiations?"
Cavendish lifted an eyebrow.
"Oh, Ferris, I'm afraid you misunderstand me. I am not here to negotiate."
"Then may I be so bold as to ask, why have you come, madame?" Grimm asked. Cavendish took another sip of tea.
"This is a Dubane leaf, is it not?"
"You have a discerning palate," Grimm replied. "My question stands."
"I'm here for Ferris's collection."
The old man stiffened in his seat. He covered it with another sip of tea, swallowed, and asked in a mild tone,
"And why, precisely, should you believe I would allow you to take it?"
Cavendish smiled pleasantly.
"Because if you do not, the two lovely young women from your group have already eaten their last meal."
Ferris stared at his tea for a moment. Then he said,
"If I give it to you, then you will release them."
"Pardon me,"
Cavendish said to Grimm.
"I fear Ferris is suffering from the first stages of senility, as I have already explained to him that this is not a negotiation."
She turned to the old man and spoke in slow, measured tones.
"I have them. I can destroy them with a thought. If you do not give me your collection immediately and without protest, I will do so."
"And then?"
Ferris asked, his voice roughened at the edges.
"And then, if you value their lives, I will continue to do exactly as I please with no further interference from you. I may even spare them when my business is concluded."
"I know you, Cora," Ferris said. "You offer scant hope for their survival."
Her eyes hardened until they looked like chips of glass.
"No, Ferris. All I offer you is the absolute certainty of their death."
The old man bowed his head and did not speak. Cavendish sat back slightly in her seat, her expression pleased.
"You needn't do it, of course. Neither child is of any long-term value to your campaign. All you need do is ask yourself one simple question, Ferris."
"Oh," the old man said.
"What would that be?"
"Do you have it in you to sacrifice two apprentices in one lifetime?"
This time the old man did flinch, as if from a slap. Grimm murmured, "Excuse me," and rose with the teapot to take it back to its heating plate. He took the mesh leaf holder from the pot and poured water from a ewer to cleanse it, then cleaned the pot out. He put the pot back down and rested his hand on the cabinet, out of sight of those seated at the table.
"Ah, a soldier's thinking,"
Cavendish said. Grimm looked back at her. She had never taken her eyes from Master Ferris.
"Captain,"
Cavendish said,
"you can draw that pistol if you choose, but you will wish you were dead before you can bring it to bear upon me or pull the trigger."
"You are a foe of Spire Albion, madame, and an active ally to her enemies. I am presuming, of course, it was you who guided the Auroran destroyers in for their attack on the shipyards."
Cavendish tilted her head, her expression pleasant, though her eyes never left Ferris.
"This is the work of that spider at the top of the spire, isn't it? He always did have a knack for picking capable agents. I'm surprised he dared to involve himself."
"How little you know, Addison, Cora,"
Master Ferris said quietly. The handle of Grimm's hidden pistol was cool beneath his fingertips.
He'd meant to have it ready in the event that Calliope had turned on him. If not unexpectedly, then at least suddenly. Only a fool would bother to attack an etherealist with a gauntlet. The simpler, sometimes treacherous service offered by a firearm was the best weapon available for such a task. I'm sure someone as intelligent as you can comprehend my dilemma, madame.
Yes,
Cavendish said, her tone dry.
You are insufficiently astute to understand the situation. But do you honestly believe I would have boarded your ship without taking appropriate precautions?
If you would be so kind, do elaborate, Grimm said.
Should I not appear unharmed and safely leave this vessel in the next quarter hour, observers posted nearby will alert my allies, and those two children will die horribly.
Grimm regarded Cavendish calmly, weighing his options. The woman was clearly dangerous and capable. Master Ferris seemed extremely cautious of her. Grimm had no doubt that she would order the execution of Miss Tarquin and Miss Folly with no more emotional investment than she might show when asking for another cup of tea. She seemed intelligent as well. He could readily believe that she would have taken precautions to prevent some sort of assault. And yet, he had little patience for one who would callously leverage young lives against her ambitions. She was not 7 feet from him. In the space of a heartbeat he could draw the pistol and discharge it, then immediately order his men to sweep the docks and trap Cavendish's eyes and ears before he could report to the Aurorans. Information could be extracted from the Watcher, and a rescue operation mounted for the young women. Such a course seemed unlikely to succeed in the face of their foe, but judging by Ferris's reaction to Cavendish, he should think it would be at least as likely to save the young women as leaving them to Madame Cavendish's tender mercies. She might be telling the truth about her ability to stop him. Etherealists could accomplish feats that would astound most men. But he had no proof of that. Did he not have an obligation to at least try to put down this foe of his home spire? He narrowed his eyes. Besides, no one gave him orders aboard his own ship. His hand settled on the pistol's grip and he began the turn that would draw it from its hidden holster and into the open.
"Hold, Captain!" Master Ferris said, his voice suddenly sharp. "Do not shoot!"
Ferris hadn't looked at him either. Grimm felt somewhat annoyed by that. Etherealists or not, these people should bloody well at least need to glance at him to know what he was doing.
"She's telling the truth," Ferris continued, his voice very quiet. "You won't be able to take the shot, and you'll be worse than dead if you try."
Cavendish's mouth split into a sudden wide smile. Ferris shook his head.
"I wonder, Captain, if you would be so kind as to have the pair of wagons in my cabin rolled out to the deck for Madame Cavendish."
"Sir?" Grimm asked.
"I believe the Spyrarch ordered you to support my mission, sir," Ferris said quietly. "Did he not?"
Grimm exhaled slowly. Then he released the grip of the pistol and lowered his hand.
"He did."
"How very civilized of us,"
Cavendish said. She set her saucer and teacup down and rose, folding her hands in front of her.
"I have porters standing by to manage the wagons, Ferris."
Master Ferris rose with her and nodded shortly.
"Let it be done."
He waited until she had turned toward the door before he said in a low voice,
"Sycorax."
Madame Cavendish paused and looked back at him.
"If any harm befalls those girls, the world is not large enough to hide you from me."
She lifted her chin, her expression cool.
"I'm not the one who has lived in hiding."
"Old man." Ferris ground his teeth, then he glanced at Grimm and nodded. Grimm escorted Cavendish from the cabin to the deck, and it was done in short order. The two little wagons, piled high with seemingly random objects, rolled down the gangplank after a couple of hired porters from one of the companies local to Habble Landing. Cavendish watched them go, smiling, and straightened the cuffs of her sleeves.
"Captain Grimm,"
she murmured,
"do yourself a favour. Live a little longer. Remain on your ship. Do not attempt to follow me."
"I will do whatever is necessary, madame," Grimm said. He bowed politely and accepted her rather pensive nod in response. Then she swept down the gangplank and departed. The moment she was out of sight, Grimm spun on a heel and marched back into his cabin. "Master Ferris, we shall leave with the shore party He broke off his words suddenly. The old etherealist was lying on the floor, curled into a fetal ball, clutching at his stomach. He rocked as if in agony, weeping silent tears.
"I can't," he said. "I can't. This isn't Grimm, Captain. I'm not capable of it."
Grimm moved to the old man's side and knelt over him. "Master Ferris, can you hear me?"
"I can, and no matter,"
Ferris said, his voice twisted as if he were being crushed beneath some brutal weight.
"I'll not be. Not for... Oh, I need 13 needles in a ball of wax, hat pins, a lump of green chalk, and 2 left slippers."
Grimm blinked several more times. The old man's collection. Was that what he was babbling about? Why?
Obviously, Grimm thought, for the same reason that Cavendish insisted that he give it up. It must have been some kind of totem or fetish to the old man. He was broken and needed the collection to help him function, just as Folly needed her jar of crystals for communicating with speech, and just as Madame Cavendish seemed obsessed with the observation of courtesy. That madness seemed to follow every etherealist he had ever met. Their power, it would seem, did not come without a price.
"Folly always got them for me. Got them perfect every time. Now she's in the dark, and it's my fault for sending her there."
The old man's eyes snapped up to Grimm, clearing for a second.
"You must find her. You must make her safe."
"I will," Grimm said. "Of course I will." Ferris clutched at him. The man looked 20 years older. His hands shook.
"Promise me, Captain."
Grimm took the old man's hands in his and squeezed.
"Everything in my power. I swear it."
Ferris nodded once, and then his face twisted in new agony, and he shut his eyes tightly, muttering to himself beneath his breath at a frantic rate. Grimm shook his head, got his good arm beneath the old man, and lugged him to his bunk. He straightened from the task slowly. He meant what he had told Ferris, but everything in his power was worth little if he did not know where to apply it. The plan had relied upon Ferris's guidance to locate the enemy. How was he to locate the enemy, pinpoint where the young women were being held, and rescue them, all without being seen by his foes? He dimmed the lumen crystals in his cabin and departed quietly, leaving Ferris to his feverish muttering. The enemy was here, in landing, but he did not know where. They were up to no good, though he did not know what their plans might be or where they might strike. He had inherited a mountain of ignorance when the old man had been incapacitated, and if he acted without knowledge, the lives of those 2 young women might be forfeit. Miss Targwyn, he supposed, was a soldier in service to the Spireark. Sacrificing her for the good of the Spire might be an ugly and unavoidable necessity. The apprentice etherealist was a civilian, but she too was deeply involved in this business, and in service to the Spireark. Yet he could not throw away their lives except as a last resort. Grimm's hands closed into impotent fists. What was he to do? Kettle came striding up the deck and whipped off a quick salute.
"Skip," he said. "There's a cat here. Bloody little creature just came running up onto the deck."
Grimm's gaze snapped up to the pilot.
Show me.
Chapter 47. Spire Albion, Habel Landing, Ventilation Tunnels. Bridget sat quietly, bound and taken prisoner, and fumed. It was even more annoying than it had been the first time, and nearly as uncomfortable. She twisted her wrists, or tried to, attempting to loosen the leather cords binding them, and once again she accomplished nothing except to make the skin of her wrists even rawer and to make her shoulders ache with the effort of the motion. She puffed out her lower lip and blew several fallen strands of hair from her face. The hair that had escaped her braid was driving her slowly insane, but her wrists had been bound at the small of her back to her own belt, and thence to her bound ankles, and there was no help for it. She wasn't going anywhere. She felt a terrible surge of frustration well up in her belly and rise toward her throat, and she knew that it was being lifted on a tide of sheer terror. Her heart started racing, and tears began to well up in her eyes. She struggled to fight against them, but in vain. All she had wanted was to stay home with her father and in the places she knew. Instead, she was quite probably to die here. And Raoul wasn't with her. At that thought, a quiet, small sound escaped her throat, despite all she could do to restrain it. She shook her head fiercely. Such despair was foolish, of course. Had Raoul been captured as well, he would surely be in no position to do anything to help her. Free, he would certainly go for help, and was quite possibly her best hope of survival. If he was free, if he had not been killed by the enemy. She shook the gibbering terror away from her thoughts and forced herself to remember her survival lessons. First, she had to take stock of her assets. While Bridget may have been bound, she was at least whole. No one had shot or stabbed her, which seemed an excellent foundation from which to build, all things considered. She was trapped in the darkness of a ventilation tunnel, one that had been barricaded with a tremendous mound of broken masonry not far from where she sat. Her gauntlet had been taken, as well as her knife and her coin purse, but her captors had not mistreated her or taken her clothing away. Another mercy. The tall warrior-born, Gwendolen, had wounded in Habel Morning, the man who insisted that he was a murderer and not a rapist, had been one of the men to secure her bonds when she had been brought to the tunnel. There was a paltry amount of illumination coming from the entrance to the tunnel, which had been blocked off with tarps on a light framework of some kind. Only a little illumination leaked around the tarps, barely enough to let Bridget see their outline, and not nearly enough to see her companion as more than an immobile lump on the floor beside her.
"Folly," Bridget said quietly, trying once more. "Folly, are you awake?"
The form beside her did not stir. Bridget heard a faint, hopeless moaning sound, hardly human, as if she was in terrible pain. Bridget had seen the men remove Folly's possessions while she lay insensible. When she had woken an hour later, Bridget had heard her move about for a moment, making frantic animal sounds, and then let out a low keen of undiluted despair. And then she had simply lain still. Bridget felt abominably weary, and desired nothing so much as to lie down on her side and go to sleep. But though she was new to the business of being an agent of the Spireark, she felt that she understood the concept well enough to know that having a nice lie down when she and the Spire were in such dire straits would, perhaps, be unprofessional. Bridget closed her eyes for a moment, though it hardly made a difference, and cudgelled her brain into motion. Had she anything else at her disposal? She blinked her eyes open a moment later. She did, for what it was worth. She had a small lumen crystal in the pocket of her bolero jacket. Granted, the little thing wouldn't show her anything she hadn't already seen, even if she could get it out of her pocket, but it was something. Perhaps a light in this darkness was what she needed most. Bridget tried to lie down and wound up pitching over onto her side. She rolled onto her back, though it hurt her arms to do it, and began to wiggle her elbows, struggling to flap the sides of the bolero and spill the lumen crystal onto the floor. Had anyone been able to see her, she felt certain she would have looked utterly ridiculous. It took her several moments of difficult, uncomfortable motion, and the skin of her wrists felt as though it had been wrapped in hot copper wire, not leather, before she was done. But then she heard it, a little click of a crystal falling to spirestone floor. The next part of the task was more difficult. She had to find the crystal, reaching awkwardly behind her with bound fingers, walking on her buttocks to scoot around the floor. That part took her at least a quarter of an hour, she was sure. And had anyone been there to see, they would have been laughing themselves sick. And her hair kept falling into her eyes, maddening. But at last she found the crystal with the tips of her fingers and willed the little thing to life. One light rose up in the hallway, and Bridget let out a sigh of relief and enjoyed a minor thrill of triumph, followed quickly by a wave of enervation that nearly had her falling over again for that nap. Instead, she forced herself to turn until she could get a good look at Folly. The etherealist's apprentice was curled up in a fetal position on the floor, and though her eyes were open, they were unfocused. Her skin was pale, almost grey. For an awful second, Bridget thought that Folly might have been dead, but then she saw the girl's body rise and fall with a slow, shallow breath, and Bridget nearly wept with relief.
"Folly," Bridget said. "Folly."
The girl's eyelids flickered, and her eyes swept about for a few seconds, as though darkness still blinded her. But there was no further response. Bridget chewed on her lip. Then she shook her head and said,
"Oh, of course, they've taken your crystals. You've no one to talk to."
Tears filled Folly's eyes. She shook her head once, slowly. Bridget nodded, thinking.
"Folly," she said, "you can hear me, can you not?"
The girl looked at her for a few seconds and blinked. Bridget tried to give her a warm smile, and then she said,
"I've a crystal here, but I'm going to throw it away now. Do you hear me? I'm going to throw it away. It's not mine anymore."
Folly's eyes widened. Bridget walked herself about until she could take the crystal in her fingers and flick it toward Folly.
"Oh!"
Folly said, as the lumen crystal landed in front of her.
"Oh, look how alone you are. And you're covered in blood, which I feel sure is not good for you, or is at least premature."
She scooted her body protectively toward the little lumen crystal until she was curled into a human crescent around it. Bridget let out a slow breath and felt her body sag with relief. Then she blinked and opened her eyes.
Blood!
She peered at the crystal and saw fresh scarlet smears there. Her blood, then. The bonds must have cut her wrists while she was trying to move them.
"Folly, can you see my hands?" Bridget asked.
Folly peered at Bridget and then sighed.
"Oh, poor Bridget. That must have hurt terribly. How bad is the bleeding?"
The odd girl shook her head.
"I shouldn't think it would be deadly to her, would you?"
Bridget nodded.
"Very well, then. Folly, I need to know what's happening. Why didn't you talk to me?" "She knew already,"
Folly said, frowning at the little crystal.
"She already said it."
"I know, because you didn't have any crystals here," Bridget said. "But I must know why you need to have them here to talk. I need to understand."
Folly frowned and was quiet for so long that Bridget thought she might not have heard the question. Then she opened her mouth and spoke very slowly, as if choosing her words with tremendous care.
"Bridget doesn't understand the toll etheric energy takes on the mind. How there's a price for power.
Always. Always a price.
How heavy it is. How it tears, holds, and holds, and holds, everywhere inside one's head.
She shuddered.
And she doesn't realize how one must find other things to fill in the holes, or else one simply falls into them, and falls, and falls, and falls.
It's not just your speech, then, Bridget said. You couldn't have acted at all.
Folly shivered again and whispered to the crystal.
I was falling and falling, lying right there, but falling and falling.
Bridget inhaled slowly.
Oh, she said quietly. I didn't know.
We don't speak of such things often,
Folly said in a sober tone.
It's bad form,
especially around someone who has practiced longer than you.
Like Master Ferris? Bridget asked.
Yes, yes, my poor master. He's more holes than not by now, and yet he holds himself together with pure will.
Folly bit her lip.
Most etherealists fall, you know, eventually.
They die that way.
Falling while they lie in bed. One cannot feed oneself while falling.
She shivered.
Some day it will happen to me and I'll not be able to come back.
She closed her eyes for a moment and then whispered to the little crystal.
Be sure to thank Bridget for me.
She's very kind.
We're friends, Bridget said. There is no need to thank me.
Folly smiled slightly. Then she moved her head, resting her cheek against the crystal, which plunged the hall into blackness again. No more than a second later there was a sound at the taps at the other end of the hall, and the warrior-born man, named Siriaco, stuck his head into the hall, holding up a lumen crystal of his own. He scowled at them in suspicion for a moment, but he did not come any closer. Instead he simply snapped,
"Keep quiet in there."
Then he departed, closing the tarp again.
Folly lifted her head after a moment and said softly,
"Don't worry. I won't let the mean men take you."
Well, Bridget thought,
she had made her situation that much better, at least. She had a functioning ally again, even if she was trussed up as thoroughly as Bridget herself was. If only she weren't bound, things might be less hopeless.
Very well, then. What could she do to become unbound?
What did the heroines in dramas and books do in such circumstances? Frequently, it seemed, they would use their feminine wiles upon their male captors, promising them amorous attention and then turning the tables upon the foe when the moment was right. But before, of course, sacrificing anything like their virtue for the cause. Bridget hadn't been an agent of the Spyrarch for very long, but she felt that she had the concept sufficiently surrounded to see that such a ploy was unlikely to work. Even if Siriaco had been amenable to such a thing, he had no real reason to release her from her bonds now, did he? And, in point of fact, what captor with any professionalism at all would be taken in by such a ploy in the first place? Besides, Bridget was not at all sure that she had any feminine wiles. And even if she did, she felt certain that they would not function as flawlessly in life as they did in tales and dramas. Leather cords. She should know what to do with this problem. Part of growing the great sides of meat in the vattery was harvesting the leather casing that grew around them as they matured. Her father could strip a skin from a side of meat with several long, deft cuts and a few expertly applied tugs. Of course, they didn't tan the leather into usable form there, instead delivering the skins to a tanner with whom they had an arrangement. But all the same, Bridget blinked again. Of course. The skins had to be stored in a tub of very watered-down solution to prevent them from drying out. Skins shrank considerably as they dried, and expanded once more upon being wetted down. Bridget began twisting her wrists again, this time in earnest. It burned, and she did not care.
"Oh," Folly said, "she's making it worse. She should stop."
No, Bridget said. She felt trickles of blood slither silently over her palms and across the pads of her fingers, and knew it had to be soaking into the leather bonds as well.
Folly, I need you to tell me when the bonds have been thoroughly soaked.
Folly stared at Bridget with her odd, mismatched eyes and shivered.
Oh, goodness. The left one needs more, wouldn't you say?
Fine, Bridget said, and focused on twisting and wrenching her left wrist especially. It took an eternity of self-inflicted torment, but finally Folly said,
She should try it now.
Bridget nodded her thanks. Then she closed her eyes and bowed her head forward. And then, very slowly, she began to apply pressure to her wrists, straining against the bonds. It hurt. Hurt terribly, and not simply in her wrists. Her arms and shoulders ached with the strain she began to put on them. Bridget was a strong girl, strong enough to toss 150 pounds of meat onto her shoulder and carry it from the vat to the cutting table without pausing to rest or put it down. She had never felt that it was really a terribly impressive thing to be able to do, since her father, Franklin, could toss one up onto each shoulder and walk along with them without breaking the rhythm of a working song. But for whatever her far less significant strength was worth, she pitted it against the Auroran bonds in a contest of endurance, determination, and slow power. And though it spread fire up and down her arms, the bonds began to stretch. It took her several tries, several painful, straining moments, but finally she rested and felt her wrists wiggle loosely. She stretched the moistened bonds one more time and then managed to wrench her hands loose.
Oh!
Folly said, her tone gleeful and quiet.
Oh, that should be in a play. That was amazing.
Bridget winced as she got a look at her raw, bleeding wrists and forearms.
Well,
she said, it's a good start, at least. Then she leaned down and started picking at the knots on her ankles with determination.
Give me a moment and I'll get yours, Folly. Will it make any difference, do you think?
Folly asked.
We shall know when we are victorious, Bridget said. Or not.
When? She said firmly. After all, a few moments ago Bridget had been bound, helpless and alone in the dark. Now she was able to move, she could see, and she was working with a friend and ally. What had changed things? What had made the difference? She had. All by herself. When the enemies of Spire Albion were in the walls, the great-great-granddaughter of old Admiral Targwyn had refused to have an eyes lie down, and it was as simple and as profound as that. Bridget looked up at the etherealist's apprentice and showed her teeth in what she felt was a very rowl-like, predatory smile.
There's no way to know what's going to happen, Folly, but we'll bloody well be on our feet when it does.
Chapter 48. Spire Albion, Habble Landing, Nineclaws Territory. Raoul hurtled down the ventilation passageways that led toward the central dominion of the Nineclaws, taking no heed for silence. Speed was everything. Little Mouse was in danger, doubtless a prisoner, and the humans could not be trusted to handle her rescue with appropriate violence. They might be willing to leave someone alive, and Raoul was not prepared to tolerate incompetence where his personal human was concerned. He had just gotten her properly trained. The first of the Nineclaws' sentinels heard him coming and emerged from the shadows to intercept him. But Raoul, Kit of Maul, had been fighting for his position since the time he could walk. He was large and he was strong, he was young and he was swift, and he was in no mood to tolerate such niceties as protocol. Raoul let out a war cry and left the first sentinel with both eyes, half his whiskers, and an entire ear undamaged once he permitted him to flee. Then he hurtled on.
The scent of blood on him was enough to make the next pair of sentinels wary, and Raoul's hiss sent them leaping aside. They took up pursuit behind him, but were careful to keep their distance. The Prince of the Silent Paws scattered guardians from his path, and collected a trailing tail who raced along behind him, their scents ablaze with wariness, chagrin, and, of course, curiosity. There was nothing like playing to their curiosity when it came to catching the attention of cats. Raoul ran an entire circuit of the Nine Claws' central chamber, gathering up every cat within dozens and dozens of pounces of the tunnels in question, and by the time he snapped to a halt in front of Norn's central chamber, there were 100 warriors and hunters following him. The entire group tumbled to a sudden halt, with the Nine Claws gathering in close to be able to observe Raoul with their own eyes. Even, Raoul noted, pleased, the guardian who had been luckless enough to be the first in his path. Two of the largest warrior cats stood before Raoul, blocking his way forward. Raoul was through with diplomacy. He padded toward them, his fur bristling, his tail lashing, and made his displeasure known with a sudden hiss. One of the warriors flinched, and Raoul discounted that one immediately from his consideration. He stalked around the other, back arched, blood on his claws.
"I will speak to Norn now," Raoul snarled. "You will escort me to him."
"Norn has not said that," the warrior began to say. Raoul struck. The warrior let out an ear-splitting yowl and reeled away, spinning madly and pawing in desperate pain at the rake Raoul had fetched him across one eye. Raoul whirled to the other guard, who skittered a half-pounds away and came to guard, his own back arched.
"I will speak to Norn now," Raoul said, in precisely the same tone of voice he had used a moment before. "You will escort me to him."
The warrior looked unhappily from Raoul to his wounded companion. Then his fur abruptly settled and he looked away, lashing his tail left and right.
"It is this way," the Nine Claws said. "Follow me, stranger."
Raoul promptly pounced on the warrior's back and set his teeth in the back of the cat's neck, a death grip if he chose it to be. The cat sent up a kit's yowl and flattened to the ground. Raoul spoke, though his teeth were engaged, as it was a cat's prerogative to do.
"I am Raoul, Kit of Maul of the Silent Paws of Habel Morning, and I'm in no mood for insolence. Do you understand?"
"I understand, Raoul," the warrior hissed.
"Run and tell your chief that I come,"
Raoul snarled, and sent the warrior on his way with a sharp nip and a cuff to his ears. The other cat shot off into the chamber ahead of him, and Raoul padded after him, as if in no great hurry whatsoever. Cats gathered around him, just as before, and Raoul could feel the eyes on him, including those dozens of kits. Good that he had accomplished most of the rough business before he entered the chamber. Kits were silly things at the best of times, and they would certainly have been imitating him in an instant had he engaged the other warriors before their eyes. All kits needed to learn about blood between cats, and what it meant, and what made it necessary. But while they huddled in a chamber full of frightened tribe members was an ill place indeed to begin their education. For that matter, he was pleased Little Mouse hadn't seen it happen. She had such a high opinion of the cat's ability to manage conflict without violence. She had never gotten it through her gentle head that there was a time for a soft paw and a time for red claws. The burden of a chief or a chief's kit was to know one from the other. Raoul entered, trailing a third of the warriors of the clan, while the other two-thirds gathered around Norn's meeting area. As he sauntered into the center of the chamber, Raoul saw Norn sitting up upon his table, staring down with unreadable eyes. The warrior Raoul had berated was crouched in front of Neen, Norn's kit, speaking quietly,
his fur flattened. Neen, for his part, looked outraged. The cats he had wounded entered. The first tattered, but in essence whole. The second might lose the eye Raoul had scratched. Bad luck for both of them. They padded gingerly around Raoul to join their compatriot near Neen. Clan Chief Norn studied the wounded warriors with steady eyes, and then drew himself up and wrapped his tail around his paws, hiding his claws. It was generally considered either a posture of peace or one of veiled fury. Norn had excellent control. Raoul wasn't sure which it signified.
"Chief Norn,"
Raoul said, not waiting to be addressed.
"Urgent matters bring me to your territory."
"Warriors!" Neen yowled to the chamber. "This creature has drawn the blood of our kin. Tear it to shreds."
A low growl rose around the room. Raoul felt a surge of something like alarm. He might not be able to fight the entire populace of the Nine Claws warrior caste with only his own teeth and claws, though it was difficult to be certain. He did not let his concern show, of course. Such things were not done. He faced Norn and came to a halt, wrapping his own tail around his paws, in mirror of the Nine Claws chief. Something like a twitch of amusement might have shaken Norn's whiskers. Then he growled, far down in his deep chest, and the room became silent and still.
"I will hear the silent pause, stranger," Norn growled.
"Father!"
snapped Neen. Norn's head turned toward his kit. His eyes stared, level and unblinking. Neen let out a low growl. Norn regarded his kit for a moment, then turned to Raoul.
"Your words will mean little to me,"
Norn said.
"If I do not know that you see clearly what troubles my realm, young Raoul."
Raoul yawned.
"Your people have been hunted like prey, O Norn,"
he replied. At that, the chamber again filled with growls of outraged pride.
"Hunted!"
Raoul snapped, rising and spinning toward the Nine Claws nearest him. Offended or not, Raoul had defeated two of their warriors, one of them the chief's personal guard, without taking a scratch in return. They shied away from him.
"Hunted!"
Raoul said again, turning back to Norn.
"Or why else have you gathered your kits into this chamber, all together, like a brood of tunnel mice? You hope to protect them."
Norn's eyes narrowed to slits. Then his tail tip twitched once, an acknowledgment.
"And?"
"Your people fear the silk weavers and their brood,"
Raoul continued.
"These are no wild creatures of the surface. These are weapons. They are under the control of a human who threatened you with the death of your kits should you not cooperate with its aims."
"He knows nothing of our ways," snapped Neen, rising and padding out toward Raoul. "Nothing of what our people may gain."
Raoul twitched his whiskers smugly at Neen.
"Ah,"
he said.
"They have offered you both cream and claw, then. What was the bribe should your people remain uncommitted to the human war?"
"New territory,"
Neen snarled.
"New tunnels and halls in which our folk can hunt, our tribe can grow. Halls free of the human plague."
Raoul regarded Neen with pure contempt.
"So said a human, do you? It must therefore be true."
He flicked his tail at Neen as he would at an annoying kit and said,
"You are no warrior. You are no hunter. You are an idiot."
"Father!"
Neen said, whirling to Norn. The fur of the Prince of the Nine Claws bristled with outrage.
Will you permit him to say such things of our clan?
Norn made a rumbling sound in his throat. Then he turned to Raoul and said,
Our kits are our future. What would you have me do?
Teach them,
Raoul growled, letting his voice carry to the hall.
Will you bow to the will of humans? Will you show them how to meow and purr for human charity next? To catch their mice and leave them as gifts? To besot themselves on human plants, human drink?
Raoul lashed his tail and bounded up onto the clan chief's furniture, all the way to the level just below Norn.
Norn, chief of the Nine Claws, I would have you show them what it means to be free, to be cat.
Raoul turned to the room before hisses of outrage could rise. I have climbed the ropes to the den of the silk weavers. He lifted the claws of one front paw.
I have slain their brood by the score, and my humans have slain them by the hundred. They are dead. Their matriarch lies dead and rotting in a human tavern. Their mature hunters lie crouched around the approaches to a human camp in your own tunnels, in territory that these interlopers have taken from you all.
He whirled back to Norn.
Now is your time, Nine Claws. They have no forces left to fall upon your kits. Now is our chance to strike them down. Give me every warrior in your clan. Let me remind them what it is to be cat, to deal with anything that could harm your kits with tooth and claw.
A chorus of excited yowls and low battle cries went up with that, enough to draw Norn's gaze from Raoul to scan the chamber. Norn's eyes came back to Raoul, and his voice dropped to a low, low growl, one for Raoul's ears alone.
Is what you say true?
By my paws and ears, by my whiskers and tail.
It is true, O Norn.
Raoul said.
He lies, Neen screeched. He seeks to use us, to shed our tribe's blood to protect his humans in their war, to leave our kits vulnerable and defenseless.
Raoul spun his head toward Neen, his vision suddenly sharpened with rage, his mouth suddenly watering with a need to taste blood.
Presently, Raoul said, I shall grow weary of your mewling.
I say this creature is a fool, Neen cried. I say that his mouth is full of lies. I say that he cannot see or hear or hunt, that this useless creature knows nothing.
The words rang out into sudden silence, as well they might, for Neen had uttered the deadliest insult one cat could utter to another.
Useless,
Raoul purred, very quietly. Silence quivered, tense and waiting.
You give me your word,
Norn growled finally, his eyes closing almost entirely.
You, a stranger. My kit tells me that you are filled with lies. How am I to know which one of you is right?
With your permission, Clan Chief, Raoul said, a growl throbbing in his words.
I shall show you.
Neen let out a hiss, his fur rising, his claws sliding from his paws. Neen was large, larger than Raoul. His fur shone with health, and his claws were long and sharp. He stood upon his home territory, surrounded by those loyal to him, and having not done battle multiple times in the past several hours, he was fresh. Raoul would have no chance of surviving battle with the Prince of the Nine Claws, not with all the warriors and hunters present who would support him. But if the clan chief permitted it, he might be able to beat Neen standing alone. Norn stared hard at Raoul for a long moment, as if waiting for any quiver of movement. Raoul faced him, completely still, showing every ounce of respect he could muster.
"Yes,"
Norn said then. Raoul, Prince of the Silent Paws of Habel Morning, let out the throaty music of his war cry and flung himself at knees.